Thank you. Madam President, standing here in this field, my first words that come to mind are, put me in, coach, I'm ready to play. What a great, 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 great university. And congratulations, Madam President, on your impending inauguration. And I hope they've warned you about selfies. And I want to say to my mom who's looking down, and to the moms here, I did offer Lauren my coat. She's got goosebumps, but she wouldn't take my coat. But I did offer. My mother would kill me had I not. You all think I'm kidding. I'm not kidding. And I want to thank the senior class and the convocation committee for inviting me to speak here today. I am truly, and I mean this sincerely, I'm honored to be asked. I have loved Cornell. Cornell is one of the great, great universities in the world. And I want you to know that there's three great ones. They're all land-grant schools, MIT, Cornell, and Delaware. And we're all land-grant schools. I almost came here to law school, but I couldn't get enough financial aid, and so y'all think I'm kidding, I'm not. Part of that was I barely got in. So I ended up going to Syracuse University. Everybody thinks I went because they gave me a full scholarship, which they did. That's not the reason. I went to Syracuse because they get more snow than you get here, off the lake. And I married a skinny Atlas girl. I think this is when the sun is shining, the most beautiful part of the world. She lived on skinny Atlas Lake, and I really do. And I got a chance to talk with some of the Cornell grads, soon-to-be grads, beforehand. Madam President and I tell you what, this child is going to end. I told her when she's president of the United States and I bring my great-grandchildren by, and they say that Joe Biden's in the waiting room, I don't want her to say Joe who. That's the only promise I asked for her. And Chewy, I can tell you something, man. You're never getting rid of that nickname. You can go to Wall Street, you can go to Japan, you can go to China, you're going to be Chewy. And people are going to be proud to know you. They're going to be proud to know you. I also got a chance to meet Rebecca Schwartz, your valedictorian from your comms department, who was in the line, and I'm sure there's a lot of other people, if I get a chance, I'd like to meet as well, who are graduating. You guys are a truly impressive group. Ladies and gentlemen, but I got to admit to you the real reason I came today. I love ice cream. I'm the only Irishman you guys know who's never had a drink and loves ice cream. And your dean of the School of Agriculture told me that this is the best ice cream because y'all have the smartest cows up here. So good to see you, Big Red. It's good to be here. To all the family members and loved ones in the audience, particularly the moms and dads, congratulations. You all get a pay raise today. No more undergraduate tuition. Look at it that way, man. Look at it that way. And I'm going to ask you something you're going to think is corny, but I mean it. All you graduates, stand up and give your parents a round of applause and thank them. Thank them for what they've done for you. But I don't know, man. Do you guys know what your kids have been doing up here? You know what the most popular course on this campus is? Wines. Wines. Pass-fail, wines. I don't know about that, man. I hope some of you forgive me. A couple days ago, I was speaking at another one of your Ivy League rivals earlier this week. hope you don't hold it against me. And I hope you sure in hell don't throw any fish at me. I know you know the school. It's that safety school. At least that's what my son at Yale and my son and daughter at Penn called it. I tell you what, how many opposing goalies have the line of faithful tormented over all the years here? I mean, you guys are tough, man. I married a Philadelphia girl. They are the meanest, smartest, lousiest fans in the world. But throwing fish at them, I tell you, you all are good, man. You all are good. I tell you, the Philadelphia Flyers would love you. They'd love you. It's amazing what all of you, all that snow has done to your temperament. As I said, I understand snow. I understand this is the first time you've had, what, 3-4 snow days in 15 years or so, or a long time? I just want you all to know, they didn't do that for you. They did that for the professors. Look, it's time to celebrate. No more prelims. You're about to graduate. And God knows, I know you'll miss Olin Library. I know you'll miss it badly, but except maybe for those two guys I saw as I flew over Lake Cayuga as I landed here trying to pass their swimming test. I hope the hell you fish them out. I mean, you know, this is, it's, you know, Cornell's a great place. It's one of the most beautiful campuses, I think, in the entire country, and I've been on hundreds, literally, over the last 40 years, and I hope it's been full of great memories for you. I hope this last week you've spent some time reliving some of the great memories you've had the last 4 years. Your last trip to the CTB, one more scoop at the Dairy Bar, maybe a tray ride down the live slope. Hope hell you didn't try it this year in the spring, but some of you probably did. The friends you've made here are likely to be with you the rest of your life. They're people you're going to be able to look to. So hold on tight to the memories you have here. This has been a wonderful trip for the vast majority of you. No graduating class gets to choose the world into which they graduate. Tomorrow, when you walk across the stage to receive your diploma, you're going to enter a world where there are a lot of Americans uncertain and anxious about their futures. Globalization has cost some of them their livelihoods. As your president can tell you, digitalization, Moore's law, artificial intelligence, with overwhelming significant promise, is also generating great anxiety among the great working middle class of this country. Some communities are struggling to get by, and they're worried that they won't be able to keep up. And we saw how playing to their fears, rather than their hopes, rather than their better angels, can still be a powerful political tool. As I said several times this commencement season, this past election cycle churned up some of the ugliest realities that still remain in our country. Civilized discourse and real debate gave way to the coarsest rhetoric, stroking our darkest emotions. I thought we had passed the days where it was acceptable for political leaders at local and national levels to bestow legitimacy on hate speech and fringe ideologies. But the world is changing so rapidly, there are a lot of folks out there who are both afraid and susceptible to this kind of negative appeal. We saw the forces of populism not only here, but around the world, call to close our nation's gates against the challenges of a rapidly changing world. The immigrant, the minority, the transgender, anyone not like me became a scapegoat. Just build a wall, keep Muslims from coming to the United States. They're the reason I can't compete. That's why I don't have a job. That's why I worry about my safety. And imagine, I imagine, like me, many of you seeing this unfold was incredibly disorienting and disheartening. Your reaction, you graduates in particular, is understandable. But I assure you that this is a temporary state of affairs. The American people will not sustain this attitude for long, I promise you. And in moments like this, it's more important than ever that we get back to basics, that we hold fast to what has always made America great and unique. To me, at its basic, it's down to a simple idea that every single person is entitled to be treated with dignity and respect. It's in our DNA. It's in the fabric of our Declaration, our Constitution. It sounds corny, but we do hold these truths self-evident, that all men and women are created equal. It's the uniting feature of what makes us who we are. You cannot define an American based on ethnicity, religion, race. America is an idea. That's the uniqueness of who we are. And it's embodied in what we say we believe, even when we haven't lived up to our ideals. Dignity has been part of our national ethic. Because we know that if people are treated with respect, if we equip them with care, the capability to care for their families, to maintain their dignity, it's harder for the politics of fear to find a home. For when a person is stripped of their dignity, they lose hope. My dad, who moved from Scranton because the job he had in the mid-50s wasn't enough to take care of the family, and set up in Delaware and was able to take care of us again, every time he'd hear someone lost their job, my dad would look at me and say, "Joey," and I mean this sincerely, my word is abiding, "Joey, a job's about a lot more than a paycheck. It's about your dignity. It's about respect. It's about your place in the community. It's about being able to look your child in the eye and say, honey, it's going to be okay." It's that basic. Your parents can tell you the single most helpless thing a parent can face is looking in the eyes of their child with an enormous opportunity or significant problem and know there's nothing they can do to help. Look, folks, the American people aren't looking for a handout. They're not looking for government to solve their problems. But at a minimum, they expect their government to understand their problems. Just understand their problems. And it helps when this generation that's emerging reaches out, because all this is personal, and tries to understand the people you're dealing with. Understand their problems. It's an awful lot harder to dislike someone when you know their dad is dying of prostate cancer, or they have a brother with a drug problem, or they just lost their mom. You may fundamentally disagree with them, but it's hard to dislike them. It's hard to question motive. And that's all we do today, is question motive. And when you do that, you can never get to a resolution. If I say your motive is that you are in pocket of this, or you are unethical about that, it's awful hard to reach a consensus. And you can't govern this country without consensus. It's the way we talk to one another, the way we act toward one another, that really matters. You don't need years of experience or even an Ivy League degree to put this into practice. It's pretty basic stuff. Everything, from your marriage, to your job, to your neighborhood, to your country, works better when we actually take time to look out for the other guy. Just treat them with a little bit of dignity and decency in our neighborhoods, as well as our national institutions. Everything works better when we honor that uniquely American, uniquely egalitarian ideal, access to opportunity, and recognize that everyone is entitled to be treated with dignity. It's not that complicated. I believe, from that uniquely American perspective, sprung this outstanding university. Quote, I would found an institution where any person could find instruction in any study. Cornell wasn't just talking about white men. He wasn't just talking about those born in the United States, not just the wealthy. He was talking about any person with the desire, the drive, and the capacity to excel. And Ezra Cornell meant what he said. His response to a letter he received asking if a young black man could enroll was unequivocal. Send him. Send him. Send him. And look what's been sent. Who knows? They may be the next Ruth Bader Ginsburg, or the next Janarino, or the next Edwin Muskie, or Gabby Giffords, who I'll see in 2 days, the next Toni Morrison, Kurt Vonnegut, the next Mae Jemison, or even Bill Nye, the science guy. But really and truly, think about it. And by the way, so can you be. So can you, the graduating class, be. And I hope you know that in no uncertain terms. I know you expect graduation speakers to tell you what you're capable of and give you advice. I don't have a lot of advice, but I tell you what, I know one thing. In order to, the people I've known that are successful and happy are the people who treat others with the same dignity that they demand for themselves. To do that, you're going to have to fight the urge. You're going to have to fight the urge to build a self-referential, self-reinforcing, and self-righteous echo chamber of yourself online. No, I mean it. I mean this sincerely. Living in your screens encourages shallow and antiseptic relationships that make it too easy to reduce the other to stereotypes. They're not flattened versions of humanity. They're not flattened versions of humanity, faster. They're a whole person, flawed, struggling to make the world better just like you, to make it in the world just like you. And you have to ascribe to those with whom you disagree the same emotional complexity you know yourself and that you possess. At the end of the day, for a person to be afforded dignity, there must be an absolute intolerance of the abuse of power. My father had another expression. He really did. He said, Joey, the greatest sin you can commit is the abuse of power, whether it's economic manipulation, social manipulation, or physical intimidation. And to go on to say, everybody asked, why did I write the Violence Against Women Act? Was my mother abused? No. My father was a gentle man. But he said the cardinal sin of all sins was to raise your hand to a child or to a woman. That's what ignited my political passion throughout my life. when I was a high school kid and a college kid in Delaware, I got involved in the civil rights movement because my state was still struggling. That's why I joined the environmental movement as I ran to push back companies polluting the Delaware River and our bay, and I ran for the United States Senate. That's why I got criticized, but I make no apologies for looking at the president of a country named Slobodan Milosevic when he asked, "What do you think of me?" I said, "I think you're a damn war criminal, and I will spend the rest of my life seeing you tried as one." That's why I wrote and worked to pass the Violence Against Women Act. Because look, if you can't be free from physical abuse, the ability to reach the capacity that you have is diminished in a significant way. Today, we're on a verge, in my view, of being able to fundamentally change the culture in this country. To fundamentally change the culture. The press always asks me, when will you know you succeeded? I'll succeed it when not one single woman who's abused ever asks herself, "What did I do?" Not one single woman ever asked, "What did I do?" And so, folks, you know, as you go into the world, you're going to have an enormous amount of pressure, temptations along the way to rationalize and to make choices that that other people want you to make. And as you move through life, you may notice yourself slipping into a bubble that prioritizes social trappings of success rather than doing what you know is right, what you feel in your heart is what you should do. Take this job. Live in this place. Hang out with people just like me. Take no real risk and have no real impact. Living a life of dignity is going to require more than just watching out for your own success. It's going to require, you can't erect a bubble around you and your family. This degree won't protect you from the pressures of a changing world. And don't fool yourself into thinking that disengaging from the system that you believe is broken is going to hold you harmless from its failures. What happens in your country, your community, your neighborhood affects you? If the nation is permanently riddled with as much income inequity today as it is, and unable to create good middle-class paying jobs in an age of artificial intelligence and automation, you're not going to thrive economically either. If your sister is a victim of domestic violence, you are violated. If your brother can't marry the man he loves, you are lessened. If your best friend has to worry about being profiled racially, you live in a circumstance unworthy of us. If the global rules that undermine our security for the last 70 years break down, we'll all be less free, we'll all be less safe. If the air we breathe is not clean, the water we drink is not pure, there's no way for you to hide. There's no way to hide. You are the most engaged, tolerant, talented, and technologically advanced generation in the history of the United States of America. But none of that will matter very much if you don't engage in public affairs. I'm not saying you all have to go out and run for office. Recent study done by Harvard Kennedy School of the millennial generation shows it's the most engaged, tolerant, et cetera, but it also shows something else. 58% say they know what happens in public affairs can fundamentally affect their lives, but only 7% of the women, only 9% of the whole population thinks they are going to get engaged at all. You have a responsibility to engage, an incredible opportunity as well when you do. It's only in moments of great change and upheaval, moments like this, you have a chance to actually bend history just a little bit to the way you want the nation to be. I know that sounds like a tall order, but sometimes perspective can be helpful. I remember sitting not far from here, where you are today, on Syracuse University's campus on their football field in June of 1968. I was graduating from law school. As we began our semester, We were certain that the war in Vietnam was about to end, and we wouldn't all have to go. But then the Viet Cong launched the Tet Offensive in an effort to end the war in one seismic single assault. 2 days into the offensive, a bullet fired in the streets of Saigon by a Vietnam police officer went into the skull of a handcuffed Vietnam soldier, and a photographer captured that mayhem. That one bullet not only pierced that soldier's skull, it pierced America's consciousness. Even those of you graduating today probably have seen that iconic photo all these years later. It brought home to everyone in my generation that there was no light at the end of the tunnel, that the comedian Lenny Bruce was right when he would say, "It's a freight train." Peaceful anti-war demonstrations turned violent all across America, and the violence in Vietnam exploded. That year alone, 17,000 of my generation died that year alone in Vietnam. Shortly after that, Lyndon Baines Johnson, who coveted the presidency, announced he would not seek re-election. In April, Dr. King was assassinated, a major political icon, a moral compass for the country, gunned down on a balcony in Memphis. Cities, including my hometown of Wilmington, went up in flames. My city was the only city since Reconstruction occupied by the National Guard with drawn bayonets on every corner for 9 months. And in June, as I walked across that stage, my only political hero of my life, Robert Kennedy, was gunned down in a hotel in California after winning the primary and becoming the de facto nominee for president. And I can remember my colleagues and I looking at each other as we graduated, thinking, how could this be happening? But in spite of it all, I never doubted for one instant that we could rewrite the outcome we were careening toward. We got involved. We turned our anger and disappointment into resolve, and I would argue into positive change. 4 years later, after I walked off that stage, I was being sworn in as a United States Senator, determined to end the war in Vietnam. Not long after that, I sat across from President Ford as a freshman senator, the youngest person in the room, as they explained, finally, with Secretary Schlesinger and Kissinger, the plan to end the war in Vietnam. 5 weeks later, the rooftop of the Embassy of Saigon was evacuating people and the war was over. So, ladies and gentlemen, graduating seniors, never doubt your capacity to make a difference. There's no reason why you and your generation, the class of 17, can't have a similar and more profound impact on this country than my generation did. And I mean it. As I said, you're the most tolerant, talented, engaged generation in American history. You have better tools to tackle the challenges that lie ahead than my generation did. There's more power in that cell phone you have in your pocket or purse than the computer that put the man on the moon. 3D printers are restoring tissue after traumatic injury. Scientists are racing to figure out how to print human organs for transplant. Technology is there to fight climate change. Cornell scientists are figuring out how to suppress the growth of brain cancer by inhibiting the ability of tumors to recruit other cells into a deadly malignancy. So make no mistake about it. We're going to be able to end the scourge of cancer and do so much more. There's so many opportunities. I'm so optimistic about your generation, and I'm optimistic about this country. The United States has never been better positioned to lead the world than we are at this moment. We have the most productive workers in the world, 3 times as productive as in Asia, the most agile venture capitalist system in the world, the greatest research university in the world, thanks to Dwight Eisenhower. We have more great research universities in America than the rest of the world combined, and that's not hyperbole. And we're at the epicenter of energy in this new century. And like I said, folks, I've met every major world leader. I know every one of them leading their country now in a major country. I've spent more time with President Xi, for example, than any world leader. I've had 25 hours of private dinners with him. I've not met a single leader who wouldn't change places with the President of the United States in a heartbeat. In a heartbeat. We have problems, but my God. And I'm so tired of both political parties. I'm so tired of the incrementalism. I'm so tired of thinking small. When has America ever thought small? We never have. It's time for America to get up. It's time to regain our sense of unity and purpose and remember who we are. With all the brain power and energy I see in front of me, I know that nothing and no one in this world can beat us. And we want these other nations to do well. But God, the idea that we are somehow behind the eight ball, it's time for the country to wake up. And ladies and gentlemen, the graduating class of 17, go out and wake us up. God bless you all. May God protect our troops. And give my regards to Davey.